We are just, can you believe, 11 days or so from Thanksgiving, and it's coming up on us really quick here. And, you know, as we were looking toward this holiday, I kept thinking about what God does in the midst of gratefulness, and I thought, you know, we ought to do a series on gratefulness just to remind us of how good that God has been to us. I know a number of you have had a difficult year this year. I had a difficult year this year. And so I thought there's nothing better than to break the stranglehold that the enemy has on just, you know, pity parties and where we're constantly being reminded of difficulties or hardships or what's going wrong in the world and everything. And so we decided to do this series. And then Friday night, we're driving to go pick up our daughter Emma from an event, and as we're driving, this guy is like riding my bumper, and I'm like, "Gosh, I missed the driveway," and so I thought, "Well, I'll just go up here to this next street, and I'll turn in and get him off my tail, and I'll turn around and go back." And wouldn't you know, he turned right behind me. He was going the same direction, and I thought, "Boy, that's frustrating." And so I set my blinker to pull into a driveway, thinking I'll just get, you know, I'll pull in this driveway and get him off of my tail. And apparently I didn't pull in the driveway fast enough, and he thought, well, he'll just go around me while I've got my blinker on, the same side I was turning to, and tore the front end of our car up really bad. And my wife says, of course, we were just thankful for this car, because we've sold our other cars, we're down to one car, and I was like, well, you know, we can be thankful that we weren't hurt any more than we were. And she didn't really answer me on that one. I think she was ready to kill me for that one. But anyhow, she has said the same thing to me. It's really easy to let things steal our joy and to keep our minds focused on what is difficult or what is brought us grief and so forth. You know, years ago, when we were living in Michigan for about 10 years, and there is a restaurant in the in Michigan and Ohio called Lee's Famous Recipe, and if you read the history, that and KFC used to be the same company, and then they had a falling out, and so they both claim to be original recipe, and so when you live in that part of the country, you're either a KFC person or you're a Lee's person, and the two just do not mix. I'm just telling you, it's you know, there's some bad blood there. But anyhow, I got to be a Lee's person. I really love Lee's, you know, chicken, and I could eat it back then. And those chains had secret shoppers. Have you ever heard of secret shoppers? You ever done the secret shopper thing? Anybody here ever been a secret shopper? You know, that was the coolest deal. I got to be a secret shopper. And what that really means is they send you these things in the mail, check in the mail, and tell you that they want you to go and buy the chicken, and, you know, and then they'll reimburse you and so forth. And so I thought that was the greatest deal because we were broke. I don't mean just like a little broke. I mean like, you know, we had 4 kids and broke, you know, just. And so the only way we were eating out at Lee's Chicken was either that there was a church potluck and someone brought it, or I got these things in the mail and we would go and they would, you know, we'd have to float the cash for a week or so till we got the check back. But it was great. And so I was so happy to have this deal, that I would do a great job. I took it very seriously. I mean, I took, you know, meticulous notes in my head and would write them down as soon as they, you know, I got away from, you know, the person. And I just really wanted to do a great job. And I was so into it, I thought, you know, I don't want to lose this job. So I wouldn't tell anybody. The only person in the whole world who knew was my wife, you know, and that was because I couldn't get away with floating the money otherwise, you know. I didn't tell my kids nothing because I thought one of my kids would surely go, yeah, my daddy's the secret shopper. You know, I just thought something like that would happen, and I thought, I'm just not letting this happen. And so so we would do these customer service things, and, you know, one of the things that Lee's knew was that despite the fact that their chicken was fabulous, is that people always had a chance to buy chicken someplace. I wonder if somebody, like, play this for the Lee's home office, and maybe my family up there. No, anyhow, we enjoyed it very much. But you know, the chicken, as good as it was, there's a lot of competition out there for fried chicken. And one of the things I started noticing as I was, you know, dealing with those employees over and over again was I recognized a pattern, you know, between the new employees and the people who had been there for a while. With new employees, the deal was that, you know, they made a lot of mistakes. They'd have that badge, you know, that says, in training and everything. And they would make a ton of mistakes, invariably get my order wrong, but they were just so nice about it. And whenever I would say, you didn't do it right or whatever, they would like scramble to do everything in their power to make it, you know, nice for me, and maybe even throw in some extra biscuits or something, you know, really nice. And so I really didn't mind. Whenever I saw, you know, that tag on that person that said new, you know, employee, I was okay with, you know, dealing with those few mistakes simply because they were so glad that I was there and went out of their way to make things right. It was great. I felt like a valued customer. And I would write that down in my report. I felt like a valued customer. They did everything they could, even though they made a little mistake, you know, and I wouldn't, like, elaborate on the mistake because I wanted to elaborate on the fact that they did a great job. Now, on the other hand, some of the longtime employees, you know, and some of them I saw because, you know, a couple of years ago, they were new employees and they were grateful and everything. And then later on, they got to be seasoned employees. You know what seasoned means? Salty. Because, see, they were no longer great. They weren't like going, oh, I'm so glad I have a job. Now they're like, this job is beneath me, and waiting on you is beneath me. And so I recognize that sometimes they might be efficient. They might be able to get my, you know, mess on a plate really fast, but it looked like a mess. So a lot of them didn't get as high a marks because they took me for granted. And I said, I felt taken for granted, regardless of how efficient they were. Never liked dealing with people who make me feel like I was a burden for buying their food and keeping them employed. And so, one of the things I learned in that is, you know, it's easy to overlook the mistakes of the new employees because they're thankful, they're grateful, they're glad to have a job. Conversely, it's hard to appreciate the skill of the others because they are not. Everybody likes a paycheck. Not everyone is grateful for the one they've got. And so they assumed that they were worth more and they made me feel like less, and I really didn't appreciate it at all. A grateful heart is powerful stuff. It helps us to overcome things. It can even, when someone around us is grateful, it can elevate, it can change the atmosphere around us. So over the next 2 weeks, what I really want to do is I want to reflect and prepare our hearts over these next 11 days when it's officially Thanksgiving, and so that we will have something more meaningful than a Thanksgiving dinner and shield our hearts potentially from the greed and consumerism of Black-Hearted Friday. And so I want us to take a look here, Luke chapter 17. We're going to be in verse 11 in Luke 17 and get our bearings as we think about what it means to be grateful. Luke chapter 17, verse 11. I'll be reading from the English Standard Version. Please follow along in whatever translation you have. Luke 17. And on the way to Jerusalem, he, that being Jesus, was passing between Samaria and Galilee. And as he entered a village, he was met by 10 lepers who stood at a distance and lifted up their voices. Jesus, Master, have mercy on us. And when he saw them, he said to them, go and show yourselves to the priests. And as they went, they were cleansed. Then one of them, when he saw that he was healed, turned back, praising God with a loud voice, and he fell on his face at Jesus' feet, giving him thanks. Now, he was a Samaritan. And then Jesus answered, were not 10 cleansed? Where are the 9? was no one found to return and give praise to God except this foreigner? Blessed be the reading of God's holy word. So here in the text, there are 10 lepers. And now, let me just say this. As soon as you read in the Bible that someone has leprosy, as a kid, I always thought immediately of Hansen's disease, where the flesh is rotting and fingers and stuff are falling off. And it could be that. But you also have to understand that the very nature of the level of science in the day and everything, that if you had any kind of outward skin disease, even plaque psoriasis, that's very treatable and not contagious at all, that word leprosy, that Greek word there, covers all of those skin diseases. So if you had a red, raw, fleshy spot on you, you were out of society. Shut out. Because they couldn't tell the difference between one and the other until it progressed. And so just first glances are how that was based on. There was no blood test. There was no scientific testing for that. It was just a safety precaution. So if you had raw, rashy, red skin, you were out until it healed. So it could be you were out for 10 days and it would heal, and then you were no longer unclean. On the other hand, it could be long term, and you could be long-term unclean. That means that wherever you went in polite society to make sure that nobody bumped into you and became unclean, that you didn't pass on what you had to do what? You yelled, unclean! Unclean! As you pass through people. Can you imagine how miserable? Let's say if you got something that's like 10, 15 days, you might stay home and send family members out, but eventually there comes a point where you're not touching family, you're not touching anyone, and where you go in society, you're yelling, you're reminding everyone as well as yourself, unclean, unclean, unclean. Now you got to understand, it was a great safety precaution when you think about it. I mean, the science, nobody even knew what a germ was. And so the whole idea of keeping the society safe from that passing from person to person was amazing in and of itself. But to be the person who was excluded would be tremendously painful and a constant reminder of your condition, because you would be shut away from other people who were clean and eventually, potentially, shut out of your own family relationships by the condition. Now, one of the things about being labeled unclean is that you become grateful for the friends you have wherever you can find them. There's just something that about recognizing that when you're in the same position or trial or difficulty. There's an old saying, misery loves company, but here's the flip side of that, the positive side of that is it has a way of breaking down barriers between people when they're sharing the same kind of suffering. In fact, one of the things that's kind of interesting when you think about it is God, who was completely untouched by sin and did not sin, sent his Son who did not sin, but because he took on humanity, suffered in all the same ways that we are, that he might identify with our suffering. Part of the kind and merciful heart of God. Not just that he would pull us up out of things in the long run, heaven, the recreation of heaven and earth together, but in the interim, that he would suffer and then identify with all those who suffer, which would be every one of us. Well, you see, here's the thing is that in their society, it was the gap that brought together Jews and Samaritans. Jews and Samaritans hate one another. it's interesting is that we see it in the Bible a lot, but even when you read other literature from the time period, or even if you read in Josephus, you begin to realize that how deep-seated the hate and contempt was between the Jews and the Samaritans, how much they couldn't stand one another. And one of the funny things is to recognize that how much they had in common, and even a lot of what we've learned about Jewish society, ancient society, we've learned from modern-day Samaritans in terms of where they worship and their Torah and their Torah scroll and things like that. We've learned a lot, actually, about Judaism from the Samaritans. And despite the fact that there was so much similarity between them, there was some differences, and it kept them away from one another and developed a level of contempt for the other person, so much so that Jews, the best way to insult another Jew was to say, "What are you, a Samaritan?" Or to insult a Samaritan was to call them a Jew. And so in that less than polite society, we find these 10 lepers. They are all shut out. They are all excluded. It's amazing how pain and suffering sometimes, that, you know, not that God creates the pain and suffering, but how He will take every hurt that we have and not allow it to be wasted. And so there's this bond that forms between this one Samaritan and 9 Jews on the road together. They become friends. They're hanging out together because they all thought the Samaritan was unclean already. But there was not many people who would hang out with an unclean Jew. So they let him hang. They became friends because of their shared pain. Now, one of the many things I love about Jesus was his constant outreach to the Samaritans. I'm just mindful of the fact that, you know, when you keep in mind that degree of hatred between Jews and Samaritans, that Jesus was always telling stories where the hero of the story was a Samaritan. In fact, we call hospitals and things, we have a whole chain of hospitals in this country that are called good. Okay, and which is a total oxymoron if you're a Jew in the first century. The words good and don't appear in the same sentence anywhere in Jewish, you know, writings and things like that. I'm just telling you, it'd be like saying good Nazi in our minds. You know, just like, you don't put those two words together. They hated these people, and these people hated them. And, you know, this one's for free, but can I just tell you, one of the things that kind of drives me a little crazy is one of the excuses of tribalism, or as we call it today, racism, is the need to point out that it runs both ways. To which I want to respond, well, duh. If you hate somebody, they will hate you back. It's amazing how that works. Anybody that doesn't like me, after a while I find I don't like them very much either. It's a terrible excuse. It's like saying, well, everybody was doing it. You don't let your kids get away with that. Don't you use it as an excuse if you have a problem with someone to say, well, it runs both ways. Just if you're in a hole, stop digging. Just, you're doing this, do this. Just, okay, anyhow. All right, so in this case, Jesus, you know, he's constantly reaching out to the Samaritans who were different, who had all these reasons to dislike them, to hate them and everything. And then now one of his stories has come to life. It's right in front of them. The Samaritan is the only one who comes back. He heals 10, and 9 go on their own way. Now, one of the things that's intriguing about this is when he heals them in such a way that their healing is apparently tied to their obedience. He doesn't say that word for word, but we get the idea. He says, go show yourself to the priests. And it says that as they were on their way, they realized they were becoming clean, that he tied the two things together. And so the Samaritan is so excited, he comes back and he worships at the feet of Jesus. He's so grateful. He wants to tell him how thankful he is. And then the others, now here's the thing I want to say in this. It's totally conjecture on my part, but, you know, if I was a betting man, I'd probably bet you on this one. You know, I don't know when we'd get to redeem this bet, but But I bet you on this one. I'm not a betting guy, but I bet you that those other nine thought that they were grateful. You know, isn't that, I mean, we're thinking to ourselves when good things happen to us, we're excited about it. We're glad it happened, aren't we? I mean, I don't care whether you ever think to write the thank you note or not. You're happy that it happened. You're glad that people helped you out, everything, you know. And there's just no doubt in my heart that the chances were that they were thinking to themselves, this is a cool deal. Look, I got healed. I'm sure they probably even said to their friends, look, I'm back. What happened? Jesus, that was great. Yeah, I was out there, you know, and I asked him. I said, "Hey, Master, Lord, heal me," and he did. And I went and showed myself to the priest, and I was clean, and I got to come home. Isn't that great? Or maybe they said, "Oh, you're great, you're back." I don't know. I don't know what happened there, but I'm just betting that there was some level of gratefulness. But there is something distinct about the fact that he recognized that what God had done for him, and he wanted to go back and thank Jesus for healing him. You know, the reality is that the Jewish lepers, regardless of what we think might have been in their hearts, didn't go back. But as the Samaritan goes back, that we see something just really powerful in just a couple of sentences. One is that when he goes back, that the Lord blesses him. I didn't read that last sentence, but it says that the Lord, it talks about the Lord blessing him because of his thankfulness. So see, he got the healing, and then he got another blessing when he came back. He didn't leave anything on the plate, so to speak. But the other thing that happens is it gives this moment for Jesus to teach his disciples. Now, notice that the spirit of which he says that he's talking to the disciples. He's not really speaking to the man when he says these things. He's speaking to the disciples. He's trying to teach their hearts. He's trying to help them to understand what has just happened here. So he doesn't just commend him and bless him, but then he uses him to make a point. Is it only the foreigner that comes back? What about the Jews? And then he commends him for his what? His faith. He points out that the faith of the Samaritan, the person who was shut out, unclean in their minds, was every bit as genuine, maybe even more so, despite their prejudices toward him. He recognizes him for his faith, and he blesses him. You know, last week I put a real emphasis on this whole thing about us knowing that God is for us. That he loves us enough that while we were enemies, Romans 5, Christ died for us, proving once and for all that he is good and that he is kind. We're reminded again that he gives good gifts to his children, but one of the things I noted that, you know, the Bible also teaches us is that every good gift comes from God, not just for those who love him, but that the rain falls on the just and the unjust. That the sun shines on the just and the unjust, on both the good and the wicked. God is not one to play favorites, but loves us all. And so we go back to the verse that's almost become cliche, "For God so loved the world," because he loved us. That's why he sent his son. The difference being this is that God loves us all enough not only to save us, but also enough to let us have our own way, even if we so choose to perish. We can say no thank you. But the point being is that God could not love you any more regardless of how good you are or less because of how bad you are. He loved you enough to give you His Son. It's an amazing gift. One that I think that we just take a little bit too for granted, because as you're in church all the time and you hear that message over and over again, that it almost kind of becomes this dull white noise in the background that, yeah, I go to church, yeah, God loves me, yeah, 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 yeah. But then whatever things are hard or difficult or trials come our way, that the thing we tend to do is just then immediately focus on those things and stack that up against the love of God, not in a fair and just way, but just simply just decide that God doesn't love us. And yet, God is not a cold, dispassionate God. So the idea that He gave us His Son meant that it was His Son that was tortured that day. It was His Son, His beloved, that was whipped and beaten nearly to death and eventually nailed to a cross, crucified upon, spat on, mocked, ridiculed. Not just a person, His Son, who did nothing to deserve the treatment. Could you think just a moment how hard it might be to love those for whom you had to make such a sacrifice, to only have them turn on you, or to disregard your gift as unimportant because, well, today somebody went around me on the wrong side and hit my car, because today somebody said something mean-spirited to me or hurt me in some way or whatever else, or stole from me or lied to me, or there's just this moment where if we stop and we move past all of our religiosity and move into that place of the tenderness of relationship with God, that we begin to recognize, what does it mean that You gave me Your one and only Son to establish the fact that You love me, that You're for me? And as much as God has given His gifts to everyone, here's the thing. It means that every lost person who does not recognize God's good gift is normal. When people out in the world just don't recognize it, it's normal. In fact, you know, we have a word for normal in math. It's called mean. Average. Normal. But one of the things that distinguishes the children of God from those who are not the children of God is gratefulness. It is inherent to the relationship that we have with God, that we become aware of what He has done and is doing in us and for us, and that we love Him, that we recognize that His good gifts are bestowed on all of us. That when the rain comes and it blesses us and provides crops for our food and stuff like that, we go, you know, God provided all of that. He's a good God. And when other good things happen to us and we see those things, when they fall on other people, we don't think to ourselves, gosh, that's not fair. They're also getting good gifts. Instead, we delight in the fact that our God is generous, merciful, kind, and enjoys blessing all that He created. But can I tell you that one of the greatest deficits, one of the things that will pull our heart further away from God, is that sense of entitlement. In this case, the Samaritan does not have any expectations or entitlement. Why would he think that he would be blessed by a Jewish rabbi? He is unclean. He's been walking through town shouting, unclean, unclean, unclean. I mean, he's had his nose rubbed in the poo. There's no getting around it. He knows where he stands. He is a Samaritan. He's out. He is unclean. He is out. And when the others start to yell at Jesus from a distance, note that it's from a distance. I'm sure that as the others are yelling, he's yelling too because he's hoping against hope. But here's the deal. There's zero expectation. Jewish rabbi going to bless you? He's just in the crowd. And the whole crowd gets healed. They already thought he was Messiah. But Messiahs are for Jews, not for Gentiles. Most of the people in the room right now, we are not Jews. And yet, we're blessed. Because this Messiah was for the whole world. But in that day, in that moment, the Jews definitely had a level of entitlement. The Samaritan had no sense of entitlement. He's just a leper. He's just a Samaritan. Shut out in every sense. And so when the miracle comes to him, there is no sense of entitlement, no expectation, or very little. All he had was faith and a man that he'd seen wandering about Israel doing good and hoped that he would do good to him also. He had heard that he did good even to Samaritans, even to Roman soldiers. And so the Samaritan leper put his faith in God while he was on the outside. And God met him in a really powerful way. God does that sometimes for outsiders, doesn't he? I mean, isn't that how you became an insider? Because while you were not raised a Jew, while you were on the outside, somebody reached out and shared the gospel with you or your ancestor so that you would be included. God does great things for people outside the faith. Often, in fact, it's one of his ways of just showing off his great love for us, of closing the gap between those who are shut out and unclean and those who are on the inside when they least expect it, when there's no sense of entitlement. And yet, isn't it true that most of us, after a little while, have a sense of entitlement when it comes to God? I do. Sure I do. I think my life should be easier and without heartache. I think that I should have a house and that I should be healthy and wealthy and wise. Not necessarily in that order, but and I think I should never suffer or have to endure pain. And I'm always surprised when it comes my way. I don't know why it comes to my door enough that you think I would have learned the lesson by now. Yet this is where most of us do. And I could point out that most of the world endures much greater suffering than we. We live in a very elite society, but we usually dismiss that anyhow when I say things like that because we're convinced that that's evidence of God's favor, and it could be. It could be. But let me ask you, what would Jesus say to us in the United States of America today? If Jesus said to Israel, his chosen people, who were blessed and highly favored, that you need to not think so highly of yourself, and that you need to not act entitled, and when I bless you, you tend to be, instead of grateful, expectant, and think that that's the way it's supposed to be because you're the chosen people. What God, might God say to us in this hour? Let me stress this. We are on the eve of Thanksgiving, just 11 days away. I think it's a cool thing that as a nation that we set aside a time to be thankful to God for all that he does to bless us, that all that he has done for our nation, we really do. We live in one, in a fantastic place. I've traveled extensively outside of this country, and I'm really grateful for the land I live in. I'm really appreciative of the many blessings that I have in this land. But I have to keep all of that in perspective to say this, that if Thanksgiving Day just is reduced to the shorthand of Turkey Day, and if it's only a preparation for shopping and greed, not that I'm against sales or shopping for Christmas presents, not at all, not in the slightest. You see, the difference between those things and an attitude of gratefulness is attitude. How am I coming to those things? Do I recognize that it's the hand of God that puts these things in my life, who blesses me? Am I thankful to him? Is there any moment that where God gets as much time as the football game? Is there any moment where more is said about God's goodness and kindness than the prayer at the dinner table? What should be our response? So, the reason I want us to stop and pause over the next couple of weeks to think about this is not because I want to make you think, wow, you know, well, that was heavy. But more of a thing to make us just stop and go, wow, do I want to be one of the nine, or do I want to be a good Samaritan? You know, how do I want to frame what God is doing in my life right now? Do I want to let all the little things and the painful things and the snickering and the backbiting and the foxes and things like that, do I want to let them nibble at the vine? Do I want them to let all those things steal all the blessings I have, to change my framework of heart, to turn my heart hard toward the Lord? Or do I want to stop even now and begin to speak blessing, recognizing all that God is doing in my life? So I asked him, I said, would you put a banner up here on the wall where people could just begin to write? Maybe you might write one thing today, and you might want to write 10 more things next week. Maybe you want to type something up so you can get it all in, because you're thinking to yourself, there's not enough room on that wall for me. I heard somebody say, oh, this is cool, I get to write on the walls. Please just stay to the paper part. But the thing is that there is something about breaking company with the nine to be the good Samaritan. Because here's the deal, at the end of the day, I have no doubt that the other nine were grateful on some level. I am certain that when they got back to their friends and family, there was a celebration. They probably sat down to a meal of giving thanks. I bet you they killed the fatted beast. Unless you're a vegetarian, then they, you know, slaughtered the tomatoes. I don't know. But anyhow, they had their feast. They celebrated that they were back. I have no doubt. I don't know. Maybe they went to the yarmulke tossing match. I don't know. Maybe they were playing dreidel all night. I don't. But here's the thing I know, is that in the midst of all of those good things that they were thankful for, that what distinguished this moment was that the Samaritan stopped. Instead of running on to Samaria, see, going back to the priest meant going back to the temple in Jerusalem. I know they're on the road, but it meant he had to go down and come back to Samaria. Everybody else went down and came back maybe to Galilee, if they were Galileans or something. Maybe they stayed in the city. I don't know how far they had to travel. But there's something about the Samaritan had to go all the way to the temple to present himself to the priest and come back and then go all the way to Samaria. And in that process, that he went out of his way to give thanks. So, in the middle of a lesson of thanksgiving is also a lesson of humility. To to stop and think. And this is hard work. It's why it's called a discipline. But to stop and think about your many, many blessings. Remember, that years ago, maybe some of you grew up in church and there was a song. I really didn't like the song, but I liked the message. Was, you know, count your many blessings, name them one by one. Count your many blessings, see what God has done. I'm not going to sing it because I don't like the tune. But anyhow, my point just being the message is so true that take that spiritual discipline of stopping and thinking and writing down and recounting. And I don't mean the things you can rattle off from the top of your head. I guarantee you that the nine could do that. So there's no discipline involved though. There's no stopping and thinking in that. I everyone in this room, we could start rattling off some of the things about home and family and different things, whether they mean it or not even. But it just gets so cliche. But you know, if your statement is my spouse is a blessing, could you please tell me why? It's easy to look at your spouse and go, oh, you're such a blessing. Oh, that's quaint and cliche. What do you mean by that? Would you stop and think and tell them why they're valuable? How they've affected your life? Is your job a blessing? Why? I mean, besides the obvious of the paycheck and things like that, but what makes your job such a blessing? What does it do in your life? Who do you connect with because of that job? Things like that. Who, what, and who are you blessed by? And then to just really take the time to think it out. So here's the deal. We've got 11 days to prepare our hearts. Not just to have a good meal and a good time. Not just to invite friends and family, not just to gather together, but to think about all that God has done in our lives, and so that on that day, more than just a little prayer around the dinner table, but in the earnestness of heart, that we might be good Samaritans and bless the Lord when we give thanks. Name those blessings one by one. Tell the person who's a blessing to you that they're a blessing and why. Tell God why you're grateful, not just in generalities, but with the specifics. Do the hard work. Let me tell you, one of the things that has been really hard work for me the last couple of weeks, I want to illustrate something to you. Please don't miss the point. Over the last few weeks, I have been sitting down doing one of the most difficult things for me to do. I have been writing the thank yous from Joel's funeral. And I got to tell you that as difficult and exhausting as it is, after I write a couple of those, and I'm just like, because it makes me remember everything, you know? I can't think about that blessing without thinking about the stuff that went with it. But I got to tell you that one of the biggest blessings in my life is writing out those thank yous. Because I do go back and remember, man, things that I didn't remember at all. I read that little note that we put there on the piece of paper, on the sheet telling us, and I go, oh, yeah. And then I start remembering even things that they did and said for us that weren't in the note. And so now as I'm remembering those events, guess what God's doing in that? He's telling me how blessed I am, how loved I am, how cared for I am. He's reminding me that in the most painful moment of my life, of how good he was to me, and what a great blessing to have the kind of people I have around me. I gotta tell you, it's hard work. It is, but it pays tremendous dividends. So as you head toward Thanksgiving, could I ask you to do that? Would you discipline yourself spiritually long enough to sit down and to remember through this year all the great things that God has done in your life, and not only to thank him, but to thank those who are responsible? Would you do me a favor? Would you post them on the wall too, so that everybody can remember how good God is? We made a double long poster instead of a single. You know what would be really cool? Is if that thing was just so full that we had to add sheets of paper all around it. That'd be really great, because here's the thing I know. That over the course of the weekend, about 300 people are going to pass through here and look at that wall. And I hope that we would recognize we have a lot to be thankful for. So share them with your friends. Share them with the people who bless you. Post them on this wall. Or, you know, if you're a social media kind of person, you say, I hate writing on paper. I just tactile thing. Okay, would you post it on social media? We've got a hashtag out there, hashtag wall of gratitude, and you can post it on there as well. I would love for you to do that. But whatever you do, make sure that you take the opportunity to publicly thank others and to thank God. Let's stand together. Ask the prayer team, you please come on up. Well, obviously, I hope that you're really going to take me up on that challenge. Remember also that we're going to have, after the second service, we're having baptisms. We're having a Thanksgiving meal. We got like 60 pounds of turkey, so come gobble up some turkey with me. Seriously, I'd love for you to take to join us. I know you came to the early service, but you can run out, maybe go home and, you know, rustle up some stuffing or something and come on back and join us. And then bless those who are being baptized this morning, praying over them, speaking God's blessing over them. If you can't hang out with us, I understand, no one's going to scold you, but I just want to appeal to you as one along the road. Would you use this season as a time to renew your heart in the Lord, to renew your relationship with Jesus Christ and with the people around you, to remember all the good that God is doing in your midst? Would you do what David did and build yourself up in the Lord by remembering even the smallest blessings? The road to healing, it runs through gratitude. And I promise you that hard work will pay off. And then, let me ask you to do one other thing. Would you meditate on those good things that God has given you? Would you take time that once you write them down, not to just post them on a wall and walk away and forget it, but would you meditate on those things? Would you add them into your prayer life? And would you tell the Lord again and again, like the psalmist says in Psalm 103, verse 2, "Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all of His benefits." He is a good God. He loves you so much, and He really does take good care of you. Would you bless the Lord with me this week out of a grateful heart? God bless you. Let's go out to love and serve the Lord together.